Featuring Joe Sweeney from Thinking Sideways Podcast and filmmaker Vincent Caldoni. This is The Shocking Details.
Hey there. Welcome to another episode of The Shocking Details. I'm Joe, joined as usual by
Vincent Caldoni.
Yeah, and it's time for a sea mystery. Yeah,
that's right. We love nautical mysteries on this show.
Yes, we do. It's our favorite thing. So this story is about the very strange circumstances surrounding the foundering of the Russian ship Mikhail Lermontov off the coast of New Zealand in 1986. And by the way, just a quick word here about nautical. I'm going to be diving deep into the nautical terms this week. Foundering, when a ship founders, that means it sinks.
And
when
I actually didn't know that term. I thought you had written flounder and misspelled it.
No. Actually, and a lot of people in the writing, they actually will mistakenly put the word flounder when they're talking about a ship sinking. They'll put the word flounder in place of the actual word founder. Which is founder does mean to sink. So that's great. You're going to learn some new nautical terms here. When I say beam, that's how wide the ship is. And when I say draft, that means how deep the ship's keel goes under the water.
I do know that term.
And another related word is the ship draws. So the ship we're talking about has a draft of 27 feet, meaning it draws 27 feet. That says they're kind of interchangeable terms.
Right.
So, okay, I think that's it for our nautical terms. There's anything else I've forgotten?
No. The only thing I saw that you left out was talking about who Lermontov was. But let's talk about the ship first, and then we can talk about...
Yeah, we'll talk about that. But it's 1986, so just to put it in its time, this was still during the Cold War. The USSR, i.e. the Soviet Union, still existed. And the Berlin Wall was still standing. So a lot of people are wondering, did Cold War politics play some role in this little maritime mystery? We'll discuss our theories later on, you know, let our listeners decide.
Okay, but first let's talk about the ship.
Oh yeah, our main character here.
As much as a ship can be a character, it was built in East Germany and launched in 1972. It was named after Mikhail Lermontov, Russian writer and poet.
19th century, dude.
Yeah. So this is back in the 19th century. It's actually pre-Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. He is definitely up there with guys, you know, like Pushkin and Gogol in terms of the great Russian authors and poets. Anyway, you look him up. He's cool.
Kind of like rock stars in America in the 20th century, though. He died young at the age of 26 in a duel. And so, you know, that's the key to everlasting fame and adulation is to die really tragically young. So, yeah, he did that. So Mikhail Lermontov. It's kind of interesting that the Russians named ships after poets and stuff.
I think that's cool.
It's kind of cool.
So the ship was 578 feet long. It weighed 20,000 tons. Or sorry, it had 20,000 tons of displacement and had a draft of 27 feet.
Yeah. Oh yeah. By the way, that's a nautical term I forgot. Displacement.
Displacement. Yeah.
Yeah. That means like if you take your ship and God's hand, you plunk it into the water. When you do that, it displaces a certain volume of water.
Sure.
And that water weighs something. So in this case, the volume of water displaced by the ship weighed about 20,000 tons. So that's what displacement means. Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we covered draft. Draft is the one nautical term I'm very familiar with because if you do any boating around Portland, Oregon, you're probably going to be in a relatively shallow river. And you're really going to want to know your draft.
Yeah. Well, the Mighty Willamette, which I spent much, much time on, just right in the downtown Portland area, has depths anywhere between 75 feet and 6 inches.
It's like, you're really going to want to watch you back out there.
You really need to know that river because it can be deceptive. Anyway, hard-earned lessons, you know, I can tell you.
I have seen some really nice boats get stuck just off the shores of Government Island.
Oh yeah,
because they underestimated the draft.
And
they got stuck in the sand. Had to get towed out by the Coast Guard. It pays
to know your river. It definitely does.
And not be too drunk while you're
motoring. That helps
around.
Too. That's the other thing. Tell us more about our ship.
So this is much bigger than a pleasure vessel that would get stuck in on Government Island. It was diesel powered, and it had two screws. So that's sort of like a propeller.
Yeah,
that powers the boat forward.
Yeah. That is actually another nautical term, by the way, a propeller. propeller crew is what people call a propeller, but actually a propeller is anything that propels your boat through the water. So
that's true.
A paddle is a propeller, like a sidewheel paddle boat. That's also a propeller.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So a screw is a type of propeller, mm-hmm. But you know, it's a, okay. So that's it. I promise no more nautical terms.
I'm learning so much.
I just can't help myself. I'm terrible. I apologize. Okay. Let's finish up with our description.
So yeah, it was built as a cruise ship. It has been suspected that it had another more nefarious purpose, which is as a spy ship. And that's a big maybe. Mm-hmm. Hold on to that one. Yeah. On its last final voyage, it carried 330 crew members and 408 passengers. Mm-hmm. And it was...
It's a lot of crew.
Yeah, it's a big crew to passenger ratio. Do you know how what the occupancy was like? Was it kind of unoccupied?
What, when it actually...
On its last voyage. Like, could it have held more people?
I think they could have stuffed a few more in there, but I think it was mostly full.
Oh, interesting.
I
mean, right. In early February, the Mikhail Lermontov, it set out from Sydney, Australia for a New Zealand cruise. So it was going to go to New Zealand.
Yeah.
And it arrived in Wellington on the North Island on February 15th.
By the way, do we need to tell people that New Zealand is two islands, or does everybody know that?
If they don't know it, what do we? It's two islands.
Two islands, North Island and South Island.
It's actually got more islands than that, but those are the two main parts.
And Wellington is at the south end of the North Island. FYI. Yeah. And there, once they got there, they didn't stay very long, actually, less than 24 hours. It's 0 hours on February 16th, which is midnight. Leaves Wellington and sails to the port of Picton, which is at the north end of the South Island, and docked in Picton at 8 a.m. Picton is at the southwest end of a really huge sound that's filled with all sorts of inlets and fjords and islands. It really would be helpful if you were to go out to a computer, if you can, and go look at some aerials of the area to get an idea. But getting to and from Picton requires snaking your ship through miles of narrow passages.
Yeah.
And through little straits and past islands and stuff. But so a local pilot is really necessary in this, if you... bringing in your cruise ship or whatever.
Fun geography fact, if you flip the world over, this part of New Zealand is at the same longitude and latitude on the other side of the globe as Oregon, more or less. Uh-huh. And we have the same thing in our home state, where there are places where you are not allowed to pilot your own boat. You have to get a pilot to take you over the Columbia Bar or around some of those fjords, especially in the north end of the state, the northwest end of the state.
So Picton is the same way. You know, it looks like a very beautiful little town, and it's in a beautiful setting. Mm-hmm. I got to go there someday.
It looks beautiful. The choice of pilot to guide the ship out from Picton was a fateful one.
Yeah, I think so.
So this pilot, his name was Don Jameson. He was Captain Don Jameson, and he was a local harbor master and a ship's pilot. He was also at the time the general manager of the local harbor board. So he's wearing like three hats. And some people think that might have played a part in the upcoming aquatic debacle.
That's what he said. He said he was overworked. Yeah, I mean,
he was reportedly working like 80 hours a week. So you could see this guy being burnt out.
Yeah, but he was very well qualified to pilot the Mikhail Lermontov. He had spent 17 years at sea. And then after that, another 16 years as a pilot. And he knew the local waters like the back of his hand. He had an excellent reputation. He was considered one of the best mariners in the entire country of New Zealand. Hmm. Somebody said about him, quote, "He can dock any ship in Picton without the use of tugs," unquote, which is back, by the way, docking a large ship without tugs, that's not something for any amateur. No. So this guy has serious skills. Okay. I mean, this guy was a top of the line ship's captain and pilot and everything, right?
Yeah.
Well, maybe. Yeah. Everybody makes mistakes. Yeah.
You get too comfortable with your surroundings, that's where accidents can happen,
I suppose.
There's that vigilance.
Yeah.
The ship cast off at about 3 p.m. on February 16th. It was headed for Milford Sound, which is at the southwest end of the South Island. Also supposed to be beautiful. I've always wanted to actually see that part of New Zealand, that very end.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I hear that. I hear Milford Sound is fantastically beautiful. Yeah. So, yeah.
The first foreshadowing of things to come was when Captain Jameson turned the ship around after pulling away from the dock. The Soviet captain, Vladislav Vorobyev, I don't know.
I think it's Vorobyev.
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 Vladislav. I think we'll call it Vladislav.
In Russian, I believe the V, when it occurs at the end of the name, is pronounced like an F.
What?
So it would be Vorobyev, I believe.
Now my Russian isn't real great, and I didn't have time to look it up.
Mine is also not fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, but yeah, he He got a little tweaked.
Yeah, he felt that the ship had come too close to the shore, and he did not like that.
Yeah, apparently he spoke to Captain Jameson a couple more times on the way out from Picton out to the open sea. He felt there were a couple of times when he came a bit too close to shore.
So it sounds like Jameson is playing fast and loose. He's maybe a little too comfy in these waters.
Maybe that was it. Maybe he wanted to show off his amazing piloting skills.
Yep. That sounds like where I get myself in trouble.
Yeah,
when
me
I think,
too.
When I think I got it down, that's where I make a mistake.
Yep.
So from there, the ship headed northeast. It had about 26 miles to go before it cleared Cape Jackson and entered open seas. Mm. And as always, you know, feel free to pause this and go take a look in the aerial views of Picton and Cape Jackson. We'll put up the coordinates. It's you want to give us the coordinates, Joe?
Yeah, the coordinates says -40.995 by 174.314. And also, if you were to go out to just like Google Maps and just type in Cape Jackson,
do that. New Zealand, that's much easier than trying to get the coordinates. You can see
that. That's an easier way to do it. It's a really narrow, twisty piece of land. It really kind of just sort of snakes out into the water way a long ways. You know?
And looking at it, so I did look this up real briefly on a nautical map. It's also got some pretty dangerous looking shallows around this spit, right? Yeah.
Oh yeah. One of which plays a particular role in this story, as a matter of fact.
About 650 meters off the Cape, there's a tiny island or a big rock, depending on your perspective. They're both. And that's where the Cape Jackson Rock Lighthouse sits. It's about 650 meters offshore. So like, you know, 0.4 of a mile, 2/3 of a kilometer. So that's plenty of room to fit your ship through.
Absolutely. It is. You know, when I first heard about this story, I got the impression from the way people talked about it, that this passage between the lighthouse and the shore was really narrow. And that it was just insane to try to go between them because there's just not enough room. Mm. But it's not true at all. There's tons of room. I mean, you could turn that ship sideways and scrooge through there and still have lots of room left. That is not the problem.
Yeah.
The problem is like it's nice. It's plenty wide enough. It's actually as wide as a lot of the skinnier portions of the ride in through the sound to get to Picton. There's a lot of narrow choke points in there that are just as narrow as this. Because if you look at the aerials of the water off the Cape, you know, even on like say Google, you know, you can tell that there's a problem there.
Oh yeah,
there's all kinds of white caps visible in the water, which indicates shallows underneath the water. Right? Yeah. It turns out there is an underwater ridge that connects Cape Jackson to the rock that the lighthouse sits on.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So you can easily take a smaller boat, even a small ship, possibly, to that passage fairly easily, but not a big ship.
Right.
You're probably looking, I think anything with a draft more than, say, 15 feet, you don't want to go through there.
Right. And well, and that gets us down to one of our other mysteries, right? Why would anybody take a boat the size of the Mikhail Lermontov through that passage?
Good question. Yeah.
And that's kind of one of our, I mean, really that's at the heart of this mysterious thing that we're talking about, this nautical event, is that
it is a mystery.
Captain Jameson, he had more than 30 years of experience.
Absolutely.
He had to have known those waters were too shallow.
Yes.
But he told the Ruskies to get in there anyway.
He did. He told them to sail on through. He told them, it'll be fine.
I mean, maybe he was really tired.
Well, maybe that's what it was. I don't know. He'd also attended a lunch not too long before that. And he drank a couple of glasses of vodka and beer.
I was wondering that.
He did. And he said later on that maybe that was not the best judgment on his part. And he normally wouldn't drink any alcohol. Although he also said he wasn't drunk. And I got to say, I don't know. You know, if I had two glasses of vodka and a beer, I wouldn't be hammered, you know?
Okay, we can get into this more in theories. But I was thinking, you know, have you ever had that thing, Joe, where you're really exhausted? You're just tired. You've just run your body too hard. And then you have a relatively small amount of alcohol and it just goes to your head. I've certainly had that before.
Yeah, certainly. I tend to more often, it's not so much my state of tiredness, it's just the contents of my stomach. I drink a lot of booze on an empty stomach.
Yeah, exactly. He was eating.
I don't know.
You know, he ate food with it. But anyway, so.
But I don't know. Anyway, so it's that's part of the puzzle here. They left at 3 p.m. At 4:30 p.m., Captain Vorobyov went to his cabin to do some paperwork. Apparently, he felt like the ship was in good hands, right?
You'd think. You'd hope.
So Captain Jameson remained on the bridge with three Russians. There was a chief navigator, Sergei Stepanishev, and the second mate, Sergei Gusev, and the helmsman, Anatoly Burin. Okay. So things went smoothly. They were still cruising on out, getting towards the end of their journey in open sea, right? Yeah. And around 5:20 p.m., Jameson ordered a 10-degree port turn. because they were nearing the end of Cape Jackson. So this new course would take the ship past the Cape to the north, around the north end of the Cape. And then 10 minutes after that, he ordered 10 more degrees port. This new heading would take the ship between the Cape and the lighthouse.
So I wasn't able to do enough research to do this. This does not seem, this would not be standard, right? This is not the normal way to take a ship out of Picton.
No, there's actually a couple of different ways. It depends on which way you're going. Mm-hmm. Like if you were headed back to Wellington, they would have taken a whole different route.
Right, they
were. Through there. Yeah, I would say that a ship that size, a normal way to go would be to continue on well past that lighthouse.
Yeah.
And then make your left turn.
Right.
Instead of trying and turning. And basically what Jameson wanted to do was make a turn and really just hug the Cape and go between the Cape and the lighthouse. And so standard operating procedure, I'm sure, was... Again, depending on the kind of boat you're in.
Well, yeah,
just, a big boat like
just
this,
looking at the maps, I mean, I'm no sailor. I don't know this stuff, but looking at the maps, it just kind of doesn't seem like it's not where I would guess you'd take a boat like this.
No, it's and a lot of, you don't even have to be a super experienced sailor to realize that a lot of it's just common sense.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
well, and that's the thing. It's like, so I was when I looked it up on Google Earth, I was trying to figure out if there was like a way he would, like a shortcut he was trying to take, if he was trying to shave some time off the voyage, and it didn't, I couldn't really see anything like that. It just seems like he did it to do it.
He just, I think it seems to me, he said later he wanted to hug the shore because he wanted the passengers on the ship to really be able to take in the scenery. And I think he was, as a local, he was kind of proud of the local scenery and stuff.
Beautiful up there.
Yeah. And so, you know, staking, you know, hugging the shore so people can really, you know, get a really close up in your face look at it. You know, I guess that kind of makes sense as long as, you know, you've got plenty of water to work with.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. He didn't have quite so much. So. Okay. So he's got so we're on a new heading here between the Cape and the lighthouse.
And the Russians, obviously not the captain, but the Russians who were still on the bridge, they were alarmed.
A little bit.
Yeah. The second mate saw a line of white water, you know, like white caps from shallow water.
Yeah, exactly.
And he asked the chief navigator what the HE double hockey sticks Jameson was doing. And the navigator asked Jameson why he was taking the ship so close to the shore. So these guys, they're experienced sailors. They're getting nervous about this. And Jameson told him, you know, no worries, mate. There's just enough water for us to get through.
Yeah, he was. And so they took his word for it because he was, you know, considered the, you know, one of the best captains and pilots in that in New Zealand. They thought, well, I guess he knows what he's doing. Yeah, this argument wouldn't really help them later on, unfortunately. So as we mentioned previously, the Lermontov drew 27 feet. Maybe Jameson didn't know that. Maybe he was under the impression that the ship only had 14 feet.
I don't buy that for a second.
I don't either. I mean, that's one of the things, if you're piloting a ship, that's one of the first things they're going to tell you, I think, is, okay, here's our draft, dude. Be aware of that, you would think, right?
So when I looked this up, when I just Googled the Lermontov, I'm no pilot. I'm no expert sailor. I would have, if I was just looking at a picture of that boat, I would give it a draft deeper than 27 feet, just guessing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're an experienced sailor, there's no, I just can't imagine an experienced sailor looking at a boat like that, even if he didn't have any information, paperwork in front of him and saying, yeah, that'll go through 14 feet of water. I just don't see that. I think I would say maybe he underestimated how deep the water was, thought the water was deeper.
Maybe he got confused about his tide tables. He thought the tide was in and the tide was high and, you know, it wasn't. Maybe that was it. I don't know.
If it was just an honest mistake on his part, and we'll get into that, I just don't think that he underestimated the draft of the boat. It's a big boat.
Yeah. So anyway, again, this is a head scratcher why he did what the hell he did. But despite their reservations, the Russians did as they were told. Again, because I said he was so highly regarded. And at 5:37 p.m., the Mikhail Lermontov hit a submerged rock on its port side. Alas, kind of like a miniature Titanic here. The rock tore a huge gash in the hull, about 40 feet long. The rip bridged three watertight compartments. Yeah, if it had been just one watertight compartment, they could have shut the doors and the ship wouldn't have sunk. But three watertight compartments, that's a lot of volume.
Yeah.
Captain Vorobyov, of course, heard the huge crashing noise and returned to the bridge ASAP. Gave the order for all watertight doors to be shut.
You'd think they would have already done that, but I guess, I don't know. The
crew is all trained on that stuff. You would think that they would immediately start closing off those doors, but I guess you still got to give the order. Got to cross every T and dot every I, I suppose. But
the crew got an estimate of how fast the water was pouring into the ship. They did some quick little back of the napkin calculations. The three watertight compartments could hold about 8,000 tons of water, but the ship could only take on about 4,000 tons and still stay floating.
So that's
not good.
No, this is not optimal. The ship's pumps could handle quite a bit of water, but they were fighting a losing battle. The crew estimated that they had about 4 hours before the ship just went down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so about 1,000 tons coming in an hour. Yep. Yeah. So Captain Jameson got on the horn and sent out a mayday call on the radio about 6 p.m. Captain Vorobyov ordered a left turn and headed into Port Gore, which sounds like a town, but it's not. It's actually just a very, very large bay that's west of Cape Jackson. And his plan was to just power on through and look for a sandy spot to beach the ship. He was just going to run her aground. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what else to do? You know?
Well, so the crew, though, they don't notify the passengers of the emergency. They did broadcast an announcement that dinner would be delayed.
I love it.
You can understand they don't want panic on the ship, but they did hit a big rock. You'd think people felt that.
Everybody heard that and felt that. And the ship took on an immediate list. And at this point was listing about 12 degrees.
That's a pretty big list.
That's a huge list. When you're inside and below decks, any list seems twice as big as it really is.
If you can imagine, tipping the floor you walk on 12 degrees, that would really feel that walking around.
It's big. Yeah, it's very alarming. I've been on a ship that was listing not even 12 degrees, and it was kind of alarming, frankly.
Oh yeah. It's weirdly disorienting. I've actually never been on a ship that had a list like that necessarily, but I've been on sets that were built canted, like movie sets and theater sets, and walking through a hallway when it's even just at like a 10 degree tilt, it's actually really disorienting. Your mind isn't used to it. You're used to the ground being level.
Absolutely. And then when you're on a ship, especially when you're below decks and you're listening like that, the first thing that's in your mind is, well, how far are we from going just like plop, just turning turtle and sinking under the waves with me trapped inside this?
Yeah, right.
Not a pleasant feeling.
You don't want to get above deck.
I don't see how the passengers could not have been aware that there was a serious problem.
Yeah, I don't know. So two vessels heard the distress call, and they headed for the Lerman Trough. They were the LPG tanker Tarahiko and...
Sorry, LPG being liquid propane gas. Yeah. Serious stuff.
Yeah. And then the ferry called the Arahura. But then at 6:19, the captain decided that the crisis was over and canceled the mayday situation. That's weird to me.
Yeah, this is another one of those inexplicable things that happened in this story that's got you scratching your head, or at least me. Yeah, he gets on the radio and says, never mind, right?
That's so really? Fishy. Yeah, what is it going to unsink? Like, you did the math. You figured out you got 4 hours.
Yeah. You got 4 hours and maybe you figured in that time, but you still, I don't know, I wouldn't turn away anybody that wanted to come in and just, stand by just in case, I would.
Especially if Port Gore isn't a real port. It'd be one thing if they're saying like, oh, we're going to dock this here. But like, he's just going to go beach it. And then you're beached and you're going to need help at some point, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Even after you beach, you're going to need to get your people off. And there was actually, this is a pretty undeveloped area. There weren't actually really much in the way of roads and stuff. And so, anyway, I don't get the captain's call there. There's some other strange stuff that the Russians did, frankly, which is, again, another reason why some people are wondering just what the hell was really going on.
Right.
But I guess, he was pretty confident they would find a place to beach the ship pretty quickly. So the ferry, the Arahura, turned around and resumed course to Picton. Although actually when they got to Picton, they disgorged their passengers and everything and then turned right around and went back out and went over to Port Gore and helped out with the rest.
Well, that's so good.
Good on them.
Good on them.
Yeah, but the captain of the Tarahiko, despite the fact that the captain of the Lermontov canceled the mayday, the captain of the Tarahiko decided to continue on to the scene anyway.
Yeah.
So also good on him.
Right. Well, because it turns out that there was a little fly in the ointment for this captain's plans. And about 6:50 p.m., the engine room began to flood. And I don't think you have to be an experienced sailor to know that's real bad.
It's bad news.
After which the main switchboard was soaked. And that's also real bad. Yeah. The pumps shorted out and the engines shut down. So now this sinking ship, it's just adrift. Yeah. That's a bad spot to be in.
Yeah. I mean, they had some forward momentum still, I think. But even if they spotted a nice sandy shore to beach on, there was now not really a good way to get to it.
Right. Not good.
Yeah. They did have one spot of good luck, and that is when the ship drifted very close to shore. It was within about a ship's length of shore, reportedly, according to some accounts. They actually scraped the seabed. That would have been a great spot to drop anchor and call it good. But the captain didn't order the anchors dropped.
Hmm.
He really should have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was hoping that the ship's momentum would just get him that much a little bit closer?
I guess that's what he was thinking. I guess he thought, well, this would work, but really, you know, I could do better, I think. Unfortunately for him, the wind had other ideas.
Went over playing your hand.
It picked up. Yeah, it picks up and starts blowing harder and pushing the ship back out to sea. So yeah, he really should have dropped anchor there. He didn't. Yeah.
This is now the first mate of call was sent by Captain Jameson. Now the Russians.
Yeah, we already mentioned that.
Right.
Yeah.
The Russians got on the radio now. But weirdly, they sent two SOS calls to Vladivostok. That's a weird place to send a distress call because it's 10,000 miles away from where they were. They're not going to be able to help you. The next thing they did is they contacted the Russian embassy in Wellington by radio and contacted the local Russian ambassador. That makes a little more sense, but it doesn't seem like it should be the priority.
No.
They spoke with the president of the Baltic Shipping Line by satellite phone, and then they radioed Leningrad, and you know, then they sent an additional SOS to Vladivostok one last time. This stuff is so weird. This is just does not seem like the thing you would do.
They sent no
SOS message on local radio channel.
Yeah, weird. You think?
What is the point? You're on a sinking ship, and you're telling people in Leningrad about it. What are they going to do?
Yeah, well, you know, as you can imagine, and we'll talk more about this, of course, that factored into some of the conspiracy theories that sprang up about this particular little tale.
I mean, yeah, it's hard not to imagine a conspiracy theory when you've got a boat full of people, crew and passengers. It's going down. It's in bad shape.
You want to contact the home office instead of calling the freaking Coast Guard.
Tell them
which is
later.
What any sensible person would do, right? I know.
They'll figure it out eventually.
At around 7:50 p.m., Captain Reedman of the LPG tanker Tarahiko came into view of the Mikhail Lermontov finally. The ship at that point was listing badly with some lifeboats already in the water, and he radioed offering assistance. Captain Vorobyov turned down the offer of Tarahiko's lifeboats, believe it or not.
Oh, gosh.
But he did ask Captain Reedman to use his vessel to push the Lermontov closer to shore. Oh. Which Captain Reedman said, no freaking way, dude, because he was carrying liquid propane. And I could just imagine like metal grinding on metal, you know, sparking away and stuff. Does that sound like a good idea to you?
Yeah, I mean, an LPG boat, liquid propane gas is, I mean, it's like a bomb. It's compressed.
Oh, yeah. There's been a few explosions in LPG ports, like right here in the U.S. that have been pretty serious catastrophes. So he declined to do that, but he anchored about a half mile away, lowered his lifeboats. And then around 9 p.m., lifeboats from the Lermontov began to pull up to the Tarahiko. And so that was good. Got some people out of the water. Some local sailors showed up as well and got in on the action. There are about 30 small crafts started arriving in the bay to help out. Because and this is like something there was a local family who had a farm right there on the Cape. They were kind of in the middle of nowhere, and they were sort of they had kind of a ham radio set up and actually did a lot of informal coordinating communications with the Coast Guard, et cetera, you know. And yeah, exactly. And so they were normally, you know, in contact with people all around the area by radio anyway. And so when this happened, it was like, you know, right close to them. And so they immediately got on the radio and started coordinating and sending out the call to everybody in the area. Mm-hmm. And so that was really a big lifesaver for a lot of these people. This thing could have turned out far worse than it did in terms of human life lost. But luckily, thanks to people like this, just some amateurs that just happened to help out, mm-hmm. you know, it turned out pretty okay.
And that's pretty amazing because, I mean, all of the incompetence between Jameson and the Russian captain.
And the Russians.
Yeah, you could really see this going a lot worse. It's cool that you know, the captain of the Tarahiko and these people on the shore were trying to help these people out despite their best efforts.
They pretty much succeeded.
Mm-hmm. By 10:50, I think the ship was a goner the moment they hit those rocks.
Yeah,
I don't think there's much they could do for it. Yeah. By 10:15, the Lermontov was listing 40 degrees over. That's
serious.
You're on your side.
That's
at 40 degrees, you'd have a hard time walking down the hallway. You know, if you're dead below deck.
Definitely, you're kind of walking on the wall at that point.
Exactly.
And of course, it's going to make it kind of hard to launch lifeboats and things like that.
And at 10:27 p.m., she went under.
She foundered.
Yep.
As we like to say, nautically speaking.
I just learned that one. Search efforts were continued in about 2:30 a.m. on February the 17th. Hundreds of survivors had been pulled from the water, but it was still assumed that at least 100 people were missing.
Which, ouch, by the way.
A lot of people, but good news.
Yeah.
Only one person died.
That is amazing.
Right. So by 11 that morning, a more accurate head count was completed and only one person was unaccounted for. And that was a Russian crew member. His name was Pavel Zagliadminov. Pavel Zaglianov. Yeah. Sure.
I think it's Pavel Zagliadminov.
Yeah.
That's close. That's pretty close to what you did.
Anyway. Sorry. Yeah. I don't know if we have any Russian listeners.
But
we apologize in advance.
Anyway, yeah. So, yeah, just and by the way, it's very tragic. I don't want to minimize the loss for him and his family.
That's a good point.
And let's face it, it could have been a hell of a lot worse.
It could have been so much worse. I mean, it really should have been worse. It's kind of a miracle. I was surprised when I read that.
Yeah. And, of course, there was a government inquiry into the sinking of the Lermontov. They released their findings in early March 1986. Captain Jameson, of course, was held responsible for the whole thing. And he, in turn, blamed his decision on mental and physical exhaustion from overwork. And I'm not so sure about this. I mean, I'm sympathetic to the guy in a sense, you know, but going through that passage is kind of like sticking your hand in a running blender. There's no amount, for me at least, there's no amount of alcohol or exhaustion that could make that seem like a good idea to me.
No.
There just isn't. I mean, the one person who was knowledgeable about the case said going through that passage in that ship was, quote, like playing Russian roulette with three bullets, unquote. Mm. I mean, I don't quite buy the exhaustion argument. Maybe.
It sounds like some terrible decision making.
Maybe I've just never been exhausted enough to appreciate, you know, what he was going through. Maybe
the thing that I would say about it is, and I'm not an expert on what it means to be a pilot in this specific scenario, but it seems to me that there should be standard operating procedures. We got a boat of this size, roughly, boats in this class. We take them out this way. Yeah. And it seems like he deviated from that. All he would have had to do, even if he was in zombie mode, was just to stick to the plan. But for some reason, he wanted to show them the beauty of the coastline. And maybe exhaustion played a role in that, but I'm it kind of seems like if he would have just stuck to the plan, everything would have been fine. Because there are, if you look at it, there are a lot of ways you can take a boat out of there that won't cause it to sink. He chose to go through an area where it was far too shallow. That was a choice he made. And obviously don't do that all the time.
And here's the other thing is he argued for that course. I mean, when the Russians on the bridge said, geez, is that a good idea? He was like, yes, it is. It is a good idea. Instead of he could have just realizing he was exhausted, said, you know, I'm going to defer to you guys in this case. It's your ship. You know, if you don't want to go through there, just go ahead and go the way you want to go. Yeah. He didn't do that. He instead reassured them. Of course, it's okay.
Yeah, it just doesn't. Something's weird about it.
Yeah, it is. But back to the inquiry. They noted that the ship was being directed by the pilot at the time of collision. Mm-hmm. But it said that safe navigation of the ship was the responsibility of the senior deck officer, who in this case was Chief Navigator Stepanishev, who was standing at the time for Captain Vorobyov. Hmm. So they shifted a little, even though they said that, you know, Jameson made the bad call, it was still the Chief Navigator's call and he screwed up. Okay. All right. Well, okay.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's really odd to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess, you know, he really, he probably should have made a different call than he did. He got some kind of harsh punishment for his role in the whole thing, unfortunately. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. Yeah.
But lastly, the inquiry report, the final report on the inquiry states that facts leading to the loss of the Mikhail Lermontov had been established beyond reasonable doubt, so it was recommended that no formal investigation be carried out. That's for a catastrophe like this, it seems like they're trying to put it to bed a little quickly to me, and it seemed that way to a lot of people, I think, probably locals. Yeah. Allegations of a cover-up began.
Not surprisingly.
It's kind of, when you don't want to do any investigating, what harm would it be just to go to investigate?
Yeah. They, for example, they didn't have an open public inquiry about the whole thing, so none of the passengers got a chance to testify as to their experiences. And by the way, if you want to, there's a lot of stuff that was written about this in like New Zealand and Australian newspapers and magazines and such. A lot of people had some pretty harrowing accounts from the passengers of their time below decks, trapped in this flooding ship, you know, that's listing at 40 degrees and just praying that the crew would come around and open up that hatch in front of them so they could escape and stuff. I mean, some pretty scary stuff.
Nightmare fuel right there.
So yeah, now, from a human interest standpoint, I mean, this is a great story because a lot of people had some pretty scary stories to tell from their experience here. But yeah, that was not to be. They didn't take a deep dive into this one. Captain Jameson, he did lose his pilot's license, but he did not get prosecuted. And eventually, it took a little while, but eventually he got his license back.
So the Soviets, they held their own inquiry, which took place in Australia. Interestingly, the New Zealand Press reported that a man with a striking resemblance to Vladimir Putin was accompanying the captain in the court.
If it wasn't Putin, it was probably some other KGB dude.
That's interesting.
So what were the results of their little Marine Corps?
What they came up with was that Captain Vladislav Voroboyev, keep screwing it up, was given a four-year suspended sentence. He was stripped of qualifications and assigned to shore duties. Chief Navigator Sergei Stepanishev got a four-year suspended prison sentence and was fined 20,000 rubles. Second mate Sergei Gusev got a three-year suspended sentence. So, Joe, what happened?
I know. Why did Jameson do what he did?
Yeah. Why? I just cannot get my head into what his mindset at the time must have been.
No, it's inexplicable.
And then we have the Russian captain.
Yeah. Captain Vorobyov made some rather questionable decisions as well.
Yeah. Calling off the SOS. We're not sinking anymore.
Calling Vladivostok and the Russian embassy. When your ship is sinking, that's what I plan to do when I'm on a sinking ship. Is call my embassy. It's like, damn it. Damn it. I'm an American. I shouldn't have to drown.
Yeah, that's so odd. So we're going to talk about some theories around this, and there are many.
At least several.
But first, we should talk about a little movie called Contact.
Oh, really? Oh, our sponsor. Yes. What a coincidence. Yeah.
The good thing about Contactee is that it is a movie by me.
Yeah.
It has Joe in it. He has a small role. And it is
extremely small.
Not some
Actually,
weird...
You cut my role. You're supposed to be a lot juicier. You cut all my lines, dude.
No, I didn't. But,
no.
Cut one of your lines.
Okay, fine. You cut my facial expressions.
Whatever. It's no small parts, only small actors, Joe. But I won't take up too much of your time talking about this movie. Most of you are listeners who have been hearing about it for, usually more than a year. But it's out there.
It's available on Amazon. I know that.
In the US and the UK. If you are having trouble streaming it anywhere in the world and would like to see it, get in touch with us. We'll make sure that you're able to watch it. It's a lot of fun. It's about a kind of shady psychotherapist who is given a patient who claims to have been abducted by aliens. He wants to prove this by taking her out of the city and hiding away with her in a inn up on Mount Hood in Oregon and trying to document this phenomenon. And that's where things start getting weird. So check it out. Tell a friend if you've seen it. Give us a good review or tell somebody. It's out there. Contact E.
Arf.
All right.
Watch it today. Watch it many times.
Actually, that would help me out a lot if you just want to let it play in the background. All right, let's get back to the story.
Well, you watch it. Your kids can watch it. Your cats and your dogs can watch it. Absolutely. And we're back. We're going to talk about some theories. You got just a few theories here. There's one, which is, believed by some that this was just an accident. Captain Jameson was simply physically and mentally exhausted. And perhaps not aided by the fact that he had a couple of shots of vodka, maybe.
Not to accuse the guy of anything, but I wonder if maybe to work his insane schedule, he might have been using some type of stimulant. And then, you mix that with vodka, that could lead to some bad decision making.
I don't know. So this is, of course, that didn't have to be such a fatal error. But so this was compounded, I think, by the Russian crew who deferred to him because of his superior experience and expertise. And really what they should have just said is Captain, with all due respect, I think we're just going to be a wusses and take the long way around instead of taking your shortcut. They could have done that. They really kind of should have. And I'm sure, especially given the punishment that was doled out to them, they probably kind of wished in the end that they'd done that, but they didn't. And a lot of big disasters do turn out to be not just one thing, but a series of bad decisions or, mishaps and stuff.
I wish I knew more about what the hierarchy with Russia. A cruise ship for the Soviets. Because I wonder if maybe, if we want to say nothing strange, nothing untoward happened here, what if this guy, by calling off the SOS, was maybe trying to avoid his own punishment?
The captain? We'll talk about this a little more in the next theory. But the fact that the captain wanted to keep any foreigners away from his ship. Apparently didn't want SOS, and he cancels the SOS because he doesn't want a bunch of foreigners showing up, Coast Guard ships, Navy ships, whatever. Mm-hmm. Maybe that was a factor in it. Or maybe it wasn't that at all. Maybe it was just an honestly bad judgment call.
Yeah.
Maybe, I don't know.
It could have just been an accident that was poorly responded to. It is possible.
Well, that's Yeah, well, but there's another theory out there that's kind of popular.
The cloak and dagger theory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, I like this one personally.
I kind of like this one too, actually.
Some have claimed that photographs of the Lermontov show that it had more antennae on it than would be necessary for a cruise liner. And
yeah, this was actually noted by a British reporter in 1972, right after she was launched. It came to London, and the reporter went down and had a look at it and noted that, wow, it's really got a lot of aerials on it. So, you know, it's like I'm kind of wondering, well, gee, is this perhaps a spy ship?
Yeah. Coincidentally, the CIA had their Southern Hemisphere intel base at Blenheim, which is just 15 miles south of Picton.
What a coincidence.
You know, so the Lermontov, it had the capacity to act as a spy ship.
Well, it appears that way. You know, you wonder, you know, as we noted previously, the ratio of crew to passengers seems a bit high. 330 crew to just over 400
That's
passengers.
Why I asked about it, because something seems odd there.
Seems a bit high. I mean, I know a cruise ship, there's got to be a lot of people, you know, waiting on the passengers and such. But still, you know, I mean, as a cruise line, how are you going to make any money?
Exactly.
If you have to have almost one employee for every paying customer, how do you make any money with that?
Yeah, I've been on a cruise before, and believe me, the ratio was not 1-to-1 of crew to passengers.
Was it 1-to-2?
Not even close.
Not remotely. Of course not. The extra crew makes you wonder if maybe those crew were necessary for some other functions, like, you know, intelligence gathering. Mm-hmm. Maybe. Yeah, perhaps. I mean,
it doesn't seem beyond the possibility that they were trying to use those antennae to intercept signals coming out of that CIA base.
Perhaps the government of New Zealand wanted the ship to be deliberately damaged. They wanted it to be sufficiently damaged that it would have to be brought back to port and maybe dry docked. And at that point, you know, they would be able to sneak agents aboard, perhaps disguised as dock workers or, you know, as shipyard workers to, you know, inspect the vessel and see, you know, kind of get an idea of what its capabilities were.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this also sort of fits in with some of the behaviors of the government as far as conducting inquiries, because there never was a public
inquiry. They didn't want it looked into.
Yeah, there was a little private closed session board of inquiry thing, which we already talked about, but no public inquiry. And it turns out a lot of the official documents pertaining to this whole thing have been sealed. They're not available to the public.
Interesting. Even all these years later.
That makes us wonder, did perhaps the government actually, so perhaps Captain Jameson wasn't incompetent or exhausted or anything. Perhaps he did what he did at the behest of his own government to give, you know, because this was suspected to be a spy ship. And that seems to me more, it makes more sense, frankly. I mean, Jameson, I don't really see how this could have been a mistake.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was saying. So he'd be the perfect guy to do it, right? Because you don't want the ship just to drop into the ocean, right? You want to damage it so bad that it can't sail away, but you want it to be more or less intact to be inspected or whatever. You would need someone who really knows what they're doing to crash that thing in just the right way and just the right place.
Yeah, he knew just right where all the rocks were, even the ones that weren't necessarily on the charts. And, you know, as I noted previously, he a couple of times on the way out, well before they got to Cape Jackson, he seemed to take the ship too close to shore. Mm-hmm. Maybe he took it in where he knew there were some rocks and was hoping to, like, you know, bang it up some and require them to go back to Picton. And unfortunately, it didn't pan out. The rocks, maybe the tide was in and the rocks just weren't quite where he wanted it to be, or God knows what. Maybe his intention there was to rack the ship up well before they got to Cape Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And then, well, now it's time we're out, you know, got all the way out to the, you know, almost to the open sea. And he's got this one last chance to run her up on the rocks. So that's what he does. So anyway.
And he got his license back, right? Yeah, that's what we said. Yeah. So in the end.
And he wasn't prosecuted. You know, it kind of makes you wonder if the fix was in here. And he was maybe doing his patriotic duty, helping out by running this thing up on the rocks.
That would also explain the captain's, so not Captain Jameson, Captain Vorbyov or whatever. That would explain his actions calling off the SOS. I mean, that's just such odd behavior for a sea captain to call off an SOS. You don't call that unless you're sure you're in trouble.
And it also fits with their behavior in terms of sending out SOSs. When they sent out their SOS calls to Vladivostok and they radioed the Russian embassy, they contact the Russian ambassador by satellite phone.
Yeah.
And they, you know, all this stuff, instead of trying to get a hold of the freaking Coast Guard, you know, or the New Zealand Navy,
exactly.
Doing this. And that makes me think that perhaps they needed to call headquarters and basically get permission to allow foreigners to come and help this ship, because it might well have been that they might have, Moscow might have said, hey, when it comes right down to it, rather than see New Zealand government officials get on that ship, we'd rather you just allow it to sink. Yeah. They had to call Vladivostok or whoever and get a call on that, get a judgment call from somebody. Somebody said, what are our orders? Do we let it sink or do we ask for help? Yeah. And that would only make sense, of course, if there was something sensitive on the ship. If it was just a matter of a bunch of passengers, you know, and just a cruise ship. And why do you need to talk to Moscow about that? That kind of fits in with our cloak and dagger theory a little bit.
I got your script, obviously this is one of your episodes. I got your script, I've been trying to say, like, okay, what's the evidence against it? Let's, you know, being, you know, some kind of cloak and dagger spycraft thing. And the truth is, I have trouble saying, like, well, here's how we know that it wasn't, right? You don't have to stretch your mind very much to say there might have been. I think we may not have it totally right, but I think there's some kind of Cold War espionage thing going on that led to the very peculiar way that this boat met its end.
I really don't think that the intelligence value of getting a chance to examine the ship would have been enough to justify what happened. I don't think that the intention, I don't think there was an intention to actually sink this ship.
You don't think so? Huh?
If this, you know, and again, this is true, and assuming they asked Captain Jameson to damage the ship, they didn't intend for any of this to be as catastrophic as it turned out.
So you're saying what they wanted Jameson to do was punch it up on the rocks a little bit, and then they'd have to go dry dock it, and they could try to document it or whatever from there.
Yeah. Ideally, it'd be something like, you know, go find some good rocks and bend the screws up some, you know, or something like that. You know, don't even punch a hole in the hull.
Right.
Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way.
Now, you have a theory about the missing man, though, don't you?
And this is sheerly speculative on my part. But what if the intelligence services believed that the Lermontov had put a spy ashore, or maybe a few spies ashore, picked them to go down and, you know, and surveil Blenheim, where the CIA base. And they suspect this, but they can't prove it. But if you put an agent on the ship and he can damage the ship enough to require it to be rescued, then what do you got to do after the ship has, you know, been through something like this? You got to do a head count, right? Mm-hmm. Of all the passengers and crew, make sure everybody's accounted for and everybody's safe, right?
Right.
Yeah. And then they got their head count, didn't they? Yep. And it turns out there was one person who didn't turn up on that head count. And now Pavel, with the unpronounceable last name, his body was never recovered. What if he didn't die?
So walk me through the circumstances surrounding this. The boat, it didn't go under the water. Pavel isn't still aboard the boat. Where did Pavel go? What is the theory about what happened to this man's body? He fell in the water?
The ship sank. The ship sank, and apparently, he could be trapped somewhere far below decks, you know, perhaps maybe in one of those watertight compartments that was quickly sealed off by the crew.
Oh, okay. So this is kind of making me sound dumb right here. So the boat is still out there?
As far as I know, I don't know what they did to salvage it, to bring it up and salvage it, but it totally went under. And if they salvaged it, I'd never heard any indicators that they found his body.
Okay. All right.
So maybe he actually did wind up floating free of the ship, but his body just was swept out to sea or something.
Yeah.
As far as I know, his body was never recovered. So what if that was the whole thing? What if the whole thing was like, you know, we're gonna damage the ship and force a head count and just see who's missing from the crew. See who's missing and who's not. So maybe that was it. I don't know. But that's sheer speculation on my part, by the way.
It's an interesting theory.
Yeah. Anyway, so the whole cloak and dagger, Cold War stuff, you know, it's plausible. I like it. Of course, it's unproven.
Yeah, no. All right. Let's get to our last theory, though.
I gotta say too, it is a little bit of a stretch to say that the intelligence services in New Zealand would have actually taken that much of a chance, that much of a risk with, you know, the ship and the lives of all the people on it.
Yeah.
Just to get a little intelligence.
Well, but I like your theory that
it is a bit of a stretch.
That Jameson maybe wasn't supposed to damage it as badly as he did.
I think that was it. And he would be the guy. If you wanted to put a guy on that ship who could actually run it on the rocks just enough to necessitate a return to port, but not enough to actually endanger anybody, he was probably the guy to do it.
He'd be the most qualified in that position.
He would be.
Yeah. I like it. I don't know. That's what I think. So let's talk about one last little theory.
There's one more theory.
Is insurance fraud.
Yeah. That's would not be the first ship that was deliberately sunk so that the owners could collect insurance because they just couldn't make money on the ship anymore. Maybe.
I guess. I don't know. The problem I have with that is I don't know enough about the nature, how do I put it, of what the insurance prospectus would look like for a Soviet-owned ship. I don't know how insurance worked for government-owned vessels in the Soviet Union. Yeah. So I can't really gauge their how much motive they would have to do this.
Well, I don't think it was at least ostensibly a Russian government ship, even if it essentially was kind of functioning as a quasi-government ship. I think it belonged to a private ownership, which was the Baltic Shipping Line.
Right, but wouldn't the Baltic Shipping Line be owned if it was Soviet? See, this is stuff I don't know. Wouldn't it be a private company the way, you know, if it was based out of Germany or the United States, it would still have government participation. This is stuff I don't know. So
yeah, if you're going to run private company, but which is basically kind of a government front to put out a bunch of spy ships around the world and stuff. Yeah, but you're going to pretend that it's a private company.
Right.
You need to act like a private company.
That's true.
Which means you're going to do stuff like you're going to buy insurance on your ship. You're not going to declare to the world, oh, you know, we're backed up by the KGB, so we don't need insurance. No. You don't do that. You know, so I think that they probably had insurance on it. In this case, they got an extra special payout too, because the Marlborough Harbor Board, who were Captain Jameson's employer, they paid the shipping line $2.5 million in damages.
Okay,
and so they got an extra special payout. They got probably some insurance money plus a payout from the Harbor Board. Now, was all that foreseeable and plannable when they were conspiring to sink the ship for insurance fraud? I don't know.
I think this one's possible. Yeah. I wish I understood better how this stuff worked. So it is a possibility. Something about this just doesn't sound like insurance fraud to me. You know, like
no, I kind of like the Cold War angle. Well, better,
okay, because personally. If they wanted. Yeah. Okay, so I guess they could have maybe over their vodka-soaked lunch brought this Jameson guy in on it. But Jameson is responsible for this. Jameson, he has nothing to do with the vessel or the insurance.
But Jameson, well, if it was a conspiracy, they brought Jameson in.
Yeah, I guess that's the only way that works.
So if Jameson is working as an agent for the Harbor Board, the Marlborough Harbor Board, then they would have liability insurance for the actions of their employees. And that is a knowable thing. You can find that out.
I'm sure, yeah.
So you can find out that, you know, okay, what's the maximum amount of their liability for what our employees do? So you can look that up, and then you can figure out, well, what kind of payout are we going to get if we wreck the ship and sink it? And so you can do it. You can actually do a quick calculation of how much money stands to be made from sinking that ship.
I mean, I guess so. Yeah.
From those two different sources of income. But again, that's just all speculative. I mean,
yeah, I don't know. But, I'm going with Cold War stuff. Honestly, it makes better sense to me, but that may be because I don't understand the insurance particulars of this thing. I don't think it was just an accident. I think it is possible that Jameson was maybe a little messed up. Maybe he was exhausted. He wasn't thinking clearly. That could have happened. The response, though, is so weird that I'm going to pretty much write that one off.
And I do think that the response of the crew to the disaster, it does suggest that there was something sensitive about that ship.
It really does. Think? It really reads that way, right? Yeah. So it could have just been a normal old accident, but then the response to it is so odd that it leads me to think that there's some kind of, there's something going on. And so, that could be an insurance fraud that I don't understand the particulars of, but I'm going with the cloak and dagger is my theory.
Yeah, no, I'm liking that one too. Of course, we'll probably never know.
I don't think we'll ever know.
Probably not. Damn it.
Maybe one day, you know, when he's done ruling, Putin will write a tell-all memoir and talk about what he was doing down there.
Yeah, if that was indeed him, I don't know. Probably, maybe it was. But I don't know. Yeah, no, there is, you know, every now and again, some of these fun, interesting things do come out. And so the problem with, of course, you know, the spy world is one of the frustrating things is often you have to wait decades to get your answers to your little mysteries. And when people finally tell all of the truth comes out, it's great. It's fascinating. But by that time, the story itself is kind of old news. It's totally interesting to me, at least.
But, I think so.
Maybe to a lot of the public, it's kind of stale.
Yeah, they lose their interest. It's crazy to think of how many people were, you know, not even born during the Cold War. The thing about it is, though, we have solved this mystery, right? We put this one in the solved basket.
Yeah, no, I think we can do that. We can take credit for this one. Sure, why not? But anyway, I think mystery solved. I guess we should just call it a week and you know.
I think so.
Say goodbye.
I think we should also remember, have people remember to give us a good rating and
absolutely
write us a positive review.
Absolutely.
It really helps us out to make this a successful podcast. You know, keep giving you the content that you apparently like listening to.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay, so anyway, and by the way, stay tuned for important information about our email address and such things. But that's about it for this week. So until next time, what is a good nautical term?
I don't know. What do they say?
What do they say? Yeah, I guess smooth sailing or something. I don't know. Yeah. Do svidaniya. That's a good one. Okay. Yeah. Which is Russian for toodaloo.
The shocking details can be found at www.theshockingdetails.com. We're on Twitter at Shocking Details. For discussion of episodes and more, our Facebook group is facebook.com/groups/shockingdetailspodcast/. Or you can email us at theshockingdetailspodcast@gmail.com. And if you like the podcast, please consider giving us a like and a positive review and letting people know about us.